The most likely thing is, you know, deferred maintenance, maintenance that has not been performed, and it's beginning to catch up with us.
Another Alaskan volcano loses all of its seismic monitors. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Monday, February 10th. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, a new lunchtime routine at Bean's Cafe in Anchorage.
I just started singing, and it amazed me about the amount of respect that I got and the quietness that happened.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station. An artist is a person who expresses themselves creatively through words, images, sounds, materials, or original performance. If you are an artist, you might be eligible for funding to support your creative work. March 1st is the deadline to apply for an individual artist award. Visit Rasmussen Foundation on Facebook or on the web at rasmussen.org for more information. This message sponsored by Rasmussen Foundation.
The Alaska State Senate has voted to reject pay raises for the governor and his commissioners. The decision was rooted in politics as well as policy. Senator Kevin Meyer, an Anchorage Republican, carried the bill, and he said the salary recommendations from the State Officers Compensation Commission were appropriate, but...
It's just that in these times of tight budgets and deficit spending, we cannot afford these recommendations at this time.
The state is facing a $2 billion shortfall, and the pay raises would have cost more than $200,000. The bill was approved unanimously and now needs a vote from the House. Governor Sean Parnell has already said he would refuse to take a pay raise, but that he thought his cabinet deserved a salary hike. The Alaska Volcano Observatory says funding constraints are making it difficult to monitor several volcanoes in the state. KDLG's Mike Mason has the story.
The Alaska Volcano Observatory confirms that all of the monitoring instruments and stations at the four-peaked volcano on the Alaska Peninsula have failed. John Power is the scientist in charge for AVO.
The cause isn't completely known as to why the sensors there have gone down. They've all sort of dropped off at different times. The most likely thing is, you know, deferred maintenance, maintenance that has not been performed. And, you know, it's beginning to catch up with us.
Power confirms that AVO will continue to use satellite data, infrasound, and first-hand reports from pilots to detect signs of eruptive activity.
But our ability to look at the, you know, the very small earthquakes that we most often see prior to eruptions, we wouldn't be able to detect those. The good news is, you know, there is no indication that this volcano is building to any kind of eruptive activity.
Four-peaked volcano lies within the Katmai National Preserve, and there have been no reported historical eruptions of the volcano. The announcement that the monitoring equipment on the four-peaked volcano was not working comes on the heels of last month's announcement that the same thing had occurred at the Aniakchak volcano, also on the Alaska Peninsula. In Dillingham, I'm Mike Mason.
Former Juneau Empire reporter Jennifer Canfield says she was fired when she refused to set up a meeting between the publisher and a legislator on a bill that affects newspapers. KTOO's Lisa Fu has more.
Municipalities buy space in newspapers to publish notices on certain information, like raising taxes, meetings, and foreclosures. House Bill 275 would give municipalities another option, publish the information electronically to be accessed on a municipal website. Representative Mike Hawker is the main sponsor of the bill. He says it would empower municipalities to find the most cost-effective way to operate.
It's information that we have determined that it is in the public necessity and good that it's made available, and as time has progressed and moved forward, there are alternatives to the traditional newspaper route of publication that might actually even do a better and more efficient and effective job of informing a public.
Juneau Empire publisher Rustin Burton disagrees.
It's a common legislative move that's made in a lot of states. It's been made before, trying to basically take public information and hide it behind a website that nobody goes to, essentially.
Burton wanted to keep tabs on the bill. On February 4th, Burton asked Empire state government reporter Jennifer Canfield to set up a meeting with Representative Hawker. Burton wanted to meet with him and intended that Canfield be present at the meeting as well.
In my mind, I'm thinking that as we're sitting with him, she's asking the questions about, you know, a reporter would be asking the questions about, you know, why are you wanting to push this bill? What's the reason behind it? What instigated it that made you feel like this was super important? It's pretty simple. You know, there's somebody pushing a bill. We want to know why. We're going to tell the story about it.
Reporter Canfield didn't think it was so simple. She didn't want to do it.
There really needs to be a firewall between the business side and the editorial side. I think any journalist understands that implicitly.
I didn't think anything of it at the time when I asked, and I didn't expect there to be such a pushback on it either. I don't know that there's anything unethical about saying, hey, we're going to go talk to this guy that's trying to push a bill, and I want to be there when you're talking to him, and you can report the news.
To Burton, it was just a meeting. He says the Empire has a financial stake if HB 275 passes, but says his concern is not about the money. He says less than 1% of the paper's total revenue comes from municipal notices. Canfield made it clear she didn't want to set up the meeting.
It was insisted that I do it, and eventually the conversation got to the point where I was told that if I didn't do it, our working relationship could not continue. I again expressed my ethical concerns and I was fired.
Canfield says she was terminated the day after being asked to set up the meeting. She says being fired is a direct consequence of her saying no.
In our conversation, it was pretty clear that was the reason.
Burton says the two events are unrelated.
A decision had been made long before there was ever anybody asking for a meeting with Hawker.
Which decision?
In relation to what our relationship with Jennifer was going to be.
Canfield is not the first reporter to abruptly lose her job at the Empire. In 2012, state government reporter Pat Forgey was dismissed from the paper. He went on to cover the Capitol for the Alaska Dispatch. His replacement at the Empire, Andrew Miller, quit just after one day, claiming the work environment was dysfunctional. At the time of the interview, Burton still hadn't set up a meeting with Hawker, but says he plans to. In Juneau, I'm Lisa Fu.
After spending Sunday listening to stakeholder committee comments on Northern District proposals, the State Board of Fisheries this morning got down to deliberations on Central Cook Inlet management changes. The board unanimously approved a proposal to ensure escapement goals for the Northern District. Commission member Larry Engel says the plan expands harvest opportunities for the drift fishery during the early part of the fishing season, and it expands fishing areas for the drift fleet until July 15th. After that date, until the end of the month, the drift fleet harvest will be restricted to allow more fish to swim into the Northern District.
So it was kind of a balancing act, and the whole issue surrounded around conservation. Every board member talked about this, and they couldn't predict exactly how this was ultimately going to turn out. But things had gotten so bad in terms of the fish passage through the Northern District, the escapements, the closures, and all this impact on tens of thousands of Alaskans that they knew they had to try something different, and they did.
Engel says the change to Central District drift management is one of the most critical issues at the meeting. He says the drift fleet will be able to catch more fish up front at the start of the season, while later season restrictions on commercial harvesters will allow more fish for Northern Cook Inlet. Mac Menard, a consultant for the Mat-Su Fish and Wildlife Commission, says sport fishermen should benefit.
It will deliver tens of thousands, if not 100,000 coho north into the streams and waters of the Northern District. There will be an immediate and measurable effect in those fisheries for local anglers this fall.
The move affects all salmon headed for the Northern District. Engel says board members put concerns about conservation of the stocks over allegiance to harvest groups. Board actions can be reconsidered within 24 hours. Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, an emotional Alan Moore praises his lead dog after his team wins the Yukon Quest.
She's just the best dog a person could have. The last 4 years, she's run back-to-back Quest and Iditarods in lead. I'm choked up. In lead.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Crowley, celebrating 60 years in Alaska, Crowley knows Alaska and uses that experience to deliver project solutions from concept to completion. More at CrowleyAlaska.com. And by the 2014 Statewide BP Teachers of Excellence Program. Teacher nomination forms are available at bpteachers.com.
Marine debris used to be mostly nets, buoys, and fishing gear, but now it includes plastic bottles, bottle caps, and styrofoam. It's everywhere. There's nowhere to put it, and more is coming in every day. Johanna Urich reports on a new museum exhibit highlighting the problem.
Some of Alaska's remote beaches are literally covered with confetti of plastic. This weekend, many of those who clean those beaches gathered at the Anchorage Museum as part of an exhibition entitled Gyre, focusing science and art on the plastic that's being carried to Alaska by huge ocean currents.
There is a shocking amount of our everyday lives in the ocean. Plastic bottle after bottle, bottle caps, shipping pallets, a toy soldier. There was a tire, a tennis ball.
Nancy Wallace with NOAA's Marine Debris Program has a list of stuff found on beaches, which reads like the items in stores anywhere in the world. Many plastic bottles on Alaska's beaches carry Chinese, Korean, or Japanese labels. Dave Gaudette with the Alaska Marine Stewardship Foundation works with remote villages. He describes the logistics of not only picking up tons of plastic trash, but trying to do something with it. His crew in Nelson Lagoon, out on the Bering Sea side of the Alaska Peninsula, dug a huge trench in the sand for 88,000 pounds of plastic trash gathered their first summer.
And then we looked at it and we said, this is not a good idea. So now they've actually bagged it, they've sorted it and bagged it, and we're on hold. We've got over 150 bags stored at Nelson Lagoon and nowhere to take them right now.
The gathered up trash has to take an expensive series of rides in small boats, planes, and or helicopters to more central port communities or fish processing plants to wait for rides out on empty barges to somewhere in the lower 48 that might recycle it. But there aren't many companies recycling marine debris. The only one taking it from Alaska stopped last year. So now the state's beach cleanup efforts are stuck, storing mountains of plastic. Andy Schroeder with the Island Trails Network says the Coast Guard in Kodiak has given them a fenced area to store it till they find a solution.
That'll buy us a season or two while we figure out somewhere new to send it.
North of Kodiak on Afognik Island, Colleen Rankin at Blue Fox Bay has been gathering plastic trash from the beaches near her home. Her yard looks like a personal dump for plastic. Some of the pieces she was more than happy to hand over to the museum to exhibit. Rankin has a plan for using shoreline trash as a building material near where it was found.
Walls could be like 4 feet thick or 6 feet thick, and lining it with some of this debris, some of the foam, and you'd have to contain it and then put it within those walls. It makes the carbon footprint of moving the debris less because you're using it on site.
Rankin points out that conventional building materials are expensive and hard to find in bush communities. You don't have to go far to find plastics. Just look at your ashtray, your computer, or the fleece in your wardrobe. Those cleaning our beaches say a good place to start using less plastic is the containers and wrappers for the stuff we eat and drink. That accounts for more than half of the trash. The problem with plastic is that it doesn't rot. It breaks down into smaller and smaller pieces. Some of it is hard to spot. Nancy Wallace with NOAA points to one example, the use of tiny microplastics by the cosmetic industry in cleansers.
These tiny pieces of plastic will clean your face, they'll exfoliate your skin, but then they go down the drain and they easily pass through filtration systems.
No matter what size it is, nothing can digest plastic. Birds, fish, and marine mammals that eat it can starve to death with their bellies full of it. One of the more memorable images in the Anchorage Museum's Gyre exhibition is a photograph of the remains of a seabird. The gray bones and feathers rotting around a bright collection of multicolored plastic bits. I'm Johanna Urich.
Alaska state troopers rescued a group of tourists late Friday night after they got stuck in their vehicle trying to get to a lodge about 20 miles north of Fairbanks near Chattanooga on an outing to view the Aurora Borealis. KUAC's Tim Ellis reports.
Troopers say they got a 911 call around 8:30 p.m. Friday from a woman who said she and her three companions were stuck somewhere on a back road off the Steese Highway. The four women from Taiwan had missed the turn to the Aurora Borealis Lodge at around mile 20 of the Steese, where they'd planned to stay for a night of viewing the northern lights. Lodge owner Mok Kumagai says the Aurora were putting on a heck of a show that night.
Wow, incredible. Yeah, best of the season, I think.
Troopers say they were unable to locate the rental car that the four tourists were driving using the GPS locator in the caller's cell phone. So they searched that stretch of the Steese until they found vehicle tracks leading into an old mining road at around mile 24. Kumagai says most any local resident probably would have quickly realized that they'd taken a wrong turn and backed out onto the road, but the tourists didn't know any better.
If you lived here, 20 yards into the road, you would have thought, okay, this is not a road. Where they went in over 3 miles, and it's just amazing that they didn't get stuck before that, which I kind of wish they would have, because it would have been a lot closer and easier.
At around 10 p.m., troopers found the tourists' Toyota Camry, where they'd gotten stuck about 4 miles down the road. Kumagai arrived soon thereafter on his snow machine and helped troopers bring the tourists out and back to the lodge, where, he says, they finally got a chance to enjoy the evening's Aurora show. Kumagai says they seemed out of sorts that night, but generally in good spirits. But he says on Saturday they began to realize their ordeal could have ended up a lot worse. Troopers say the temperature that night was about 4 above and that winds were stiff.
I wouldn't say freaked out, but still not understanding the potential disaster that could have been. Until yesterday when they got the towing bill, I think they said, you know, it's a lesson learned.
Kumagai says he's never had a problem like this in the 5 years he's been running the lodge. In Fairbanks, I'm Tim Ellis.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by ConocoPhillips. The easy oil is gone, and getting to the remaining oil will be a challenge that will require the state and the industry to work together. ConocoPhillips, Alaska's oil and gas company. Alaska's Tobacco Quitline is ready to help you succeed in your decision to quit tobacco. Take advantage of proven successful free resources. Trained quit coaches will provide support services to help you quit for good with confidential counseling. There's free nicotine replacement therapy and a tailored quit plan just for you. For more information, call 1-800-QUIT-NOW or visit AlaskaQuitline.com. This message sponsored by the Alaska Tobacco Control Alliance.
The Iditarod Trail Committee is considering moving the restart of the race from Willow to Fairbanks. Saturday's statement says the ceremonial start will take place on March 1st in Anchorage as planned, and the current plan is to have the restart where the competitive part of the race truly begins in Willow the next day. But there are concerns about trail conditions between Rainy Pass and Nikolai. If the trail isn't acceptable by the beginning of next week, the restart will be moved to Fairbanks on March 3rd. Moving the start of the race would mean logistical challenges for race officials and mushers. In addition, many Mat-Su Valley businesses bring in significant income during the Iditarod. Now, race officials, mushers, fans, and business owners will be watching the weather forecast, hoping for good news. A final decision is expected sometime next Monday. Alan Moore has won the Yukon Quest International Sled Dog Race for the second consecutive year. Moore's team is known for its petite stature, perky ears, and wagging tails, and they didn't disappoint. They jumped in harness and yelped after arriving at Tokini Hot Springs, 30 miles outside of Whitehorse.
He's still in the dark, and he's coming underneath the anything and all.
But Moore's win is bittersweet. What was expected to be a foot race to the finish turned into a solo run after Eureka musher Brent Sass sustained a minor head injury Sunday morning, roughly 80 miles from the finish. The accident was clearly difficult for Moore as he crossed the finish line.
It would have been interesting, especially for the media, if Brent hadn't got injured, because we would have been neck and neck all the way here. We'd have probably both slid around that corner right there. So anyway, he said next year.
This is Moore's fourth top 10 finish in as many years. He said he also had to catch his breath when asked about his lead dog, Keto.
Keto's been in every one of our races, and she's always been in lead. in lead, and she's just the best dog a person could have. She's, the last 4 years, she's run back-to-back Quest and Iditarods in lead. Man, I'm choked up. in lead, and I wish we had a lot more like her.
Keto led the team in single lead for much of the race. When she wasn't running alone, she was running next to a tri-collared leader named Scruggs. Moore says he plans to be back for the race, and he expects Keto and Scruggs are likely to run the Quest again next year.
Well, I would hope so, until she tells us she don't want to do it anymore. And she hasn't said that yet. And she's just six or seven, one of the two.
There are still 12 teams on the trail. They will continue to make their way toward the finish line throughout the week. The finish line was relocated 30 miles from downtown Whitehorse due to weak ice on the Yukon River and poor trail conditions. The change and the elimination of American Summit outside of Eagle shortened the total distance by roughly 50 miles. At midday, huge crowds of homeless men and women filter inside the warm warehouse-sized cafeteria at Bean's Cafe in downtown Anchorage for meals and socializing. It can be noisy and chaotic. For many, it's their only respite from the cold and dust outside on the city streets. But once a week, volunteers recently began serving up more than a hot meal. KSKA's Daisha Eaton has the story.
Dressed in a traditional fringed and beaded moosehide jacket, when Samuel Johns steps into the industrial-sized building filled with cafeteria tables, heads turn. Some of the homeless people ask about his jacket, others about his drum, with the word Atna scrolled across the front and two red feathers on either side. Even more gather round when he brings out his stick and starts pounding out the beat. His cousin Andrew wears a black hoodie and dances and sings at his side. During a recent one-day point-in-time survey, the Alaska Housing Finance Corporation found the majority of chronically homeless people in Anchorage, around 70% of the 700 or so homeless people surveyed, self-identified as Alaska Native. John's noticed, too. He says he got the idea to start drumming at Bean's while volunteering there a few weeks ago. At the end of the song, the audience lets out sounds of approval. 28-year-old Johns grew up in Copper Center, or as he calls it, Eklutika. He's Atna and Gwich'in Athabaskan. By his own account, Johns could have been among the men and women with substance abuse issues at Bean's. He spent his youth drinking to numb out emotions, he says, that he didn't know how to deal with. Traditional songs, drumming, and dancing helped him find connection again and get sober when he was 21. He says he was apprehensive about how he'd be received, but something cool happened when he started drumming and singing at Bean's.
I just started singing, and it amazed me about the amount of respect that I got and the quietness that happened.
Quietness followed by request after request for traditional Native songs from every corner of Alaska. Ed Pratt, who says he's Tlingit from Hoona and Juneau, asked Johns to play a song to honor a friend who recently died.
I love the drumming because it takes me away from myself.
Vernita Ballett, who's Inupiaq from Selawik, likes the drumming too.
Drive me crazy.
In a good way.
In a good, beautiful way.
Does it remind you of home?
It reminds me a lot from the way long ago people, Inupiaq people, they used to drum too, you know, and dance. They taught me how. I know a little bit about it, but, you know, just to hear them drumming, it's beautiful. I love it. Made me feel young again.
Our Native dancing and drumming long ago was kind of our form of going to church.
That's Ed Tilana, a cultural programs coordinator at the Alaska Native Heritage Center.
Before Western civilization came to Alaska and religion came to Alaska. This was our way of making prayer, to honor animals, to honor our ancestors, the land, and to share stories with everybody.
Tilana learned traditional drumming from his grandparents, who come from King Island, while he was growing up in Anchorage. He says they taught him that drums are used to replicate the sound of your mother's heartbeat, and that they help you relax, release energy, and feel connection. With Alaska Native culture still in transition from traditional to modern times, Tilana says the drum is a way to connect with healthy traditions and find a way forward.
Physical abuse, mental abuse, alcohol, drug abuse, you know, these things we tend to get lost in, and then we are disconnected from our culture. But when we hear our drumming and our singing, that fills an empty spot in our heart.
A spot John says he's excited to help fill with his drum.
Our drum is like medicine. Our drum is a tool for healing. And that's what I was telling them while we were down there, is you don't just buy this thing at a store. You don't get this at the hospital. It's something that's been passed down from generation to generation for a reason.
John's only knows songs from his region. He hopes Alaska Native people from other regions will join him to drum, sing, and dance with the people at Beans Cafe soon. In Anchorage, I'm Daisha Eaton.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at alaskapublic.org, and you can follow us on Twitter at APRN. We had reports tonight from Mike Mason in Dillingham, Lisa Fu in Juneau, Ellen Lockyer, Johanna Urich, and Daisha Eaton in Anchorage, Tim Ellis in Delta, Philip Manning in Talkeetna, and Emily Schwing in Whitehorse. APRN's Alexander Gutierrez reported from Juneau. Our editor and producer is Annie Feit. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron. Kristen Spack is our web producer, and I'm Lori Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by
BP Alaska. As part of their commitment to Alaska, BP and their employees are investing in over 400 education and service organizations in communities across the state. More at alaska.bp.com. Doyon Limited, announcing the 2014 Board of Directors election beginning January 22nd. Early bid proxy submission needed by Friday, February 14th. Information at doyon.com. And by Wells Fargo, proud supporter of APRN and dedicated to having conversations that help businesses and individuals succeed financially, because an open dialogue can open doors. Wells Fargo, together we'll go far. The State of Alaska Department of Revenue reminds you to file online now for your 2014 PFD. Paper applications are located in your community. More information at pfd.alaska.gov or on Facebook. This message sponsored by the State of Alaska.
ANSEP, the Alaska Native Science and Engineering Program, gives Alaska Native students the inspiration and opportunity to excel in science and engineering careers, building a sustainable future for Alaska. More at ANSEP.net. This message sponsored by ANSEP.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.